Back to Paris now, where ministers from 195 nations are negotiating the final text of a new international treaty on climate change. As the weekend deadline looms, disagreements remain over the treaty's long-term goals and whether it will be legally binding. Someone who's no stranger to the discord of international climate change summits is Helen Clark, now head of the United Nations Development Programme, former Prime Minister of New Zealand. She says that while Paris itself isn't going to stop climate change, delegates must use the conference to produce a roadmap towards that ultimate goal. Helen Clark with us now from Paris. Welcome back to RN Breakfast.
Thank you very much, James.
So are you anticipating an agreement?
Well, atmosphere is good for an agreement. The issue is how strong the agreement's going to be. And you correctly paraphrased me in saying that Paris isn't the end of the story. What has run up to these negotiations is most of the world's countries putting in their climate action commitments to say what they will do to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But at this point, if we add all those commitments up, it doesn't get global temperature rise below that critical 2 degrees Celsius level. It's sitting at about 2.7 at the moment. And of course, also at the conference, many big and powerful countries, the United States and European Union as a whole, are saying, well, maybe we ought to be looking at 1.5 as the peak, not 2. So we're quite a way off that. So one of the really critical things to watch for in this agreement is, will it have a review clause which will ask countries to come back within the next 5 years with more ambitious commitments on reducing their greenhouse gas emissions?
Does that mean if the deal is not as strong as some people would have hoped, but that review mechanism is in, it won't be, pardon the pun, the end of the world?
That's correct. There's nothing really we can do now to change the fact that the commitments countries have made are not yet good enough, if I could put it that way. But I think if we can get on after this agreement, hopefully an agreement, with implementation of the commitments the countries have made, that will pave the way for more ambition as they see that it is possible to do this.
And will that make this, Paris, different to preceding international conferences?
Yes, this is very, very different. One meeting of many I was at today with the European Climate Change Commissioner, he said, look how different this is from Kyoto. The conference that produced the Kyoto Protocol produced one with binding commitments for a small number of countries, essentially advanced economies like Australia and New Zealand. Now, we come to this Paris COP with virtually every country on earth making climate action commitments to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. So this has to be a huge step forward. So we're over the hump, I think, of developing countries saying, you rich countries do it, it's your fault, to actually everybody realizing that they have to do something. Because even if every advanced economy, like Australia, like the US, like New Zealand, were to completely go carbon neutral, eliminate carbon from their economy, we would still have a problem because there is a huge fossil fuel footprint in China, in emerging economies, and if other poorer countries start developing with a heavy fossil fuel footprint, then of course the problem grows. So everybody needs to commit to a cleaner path. And I think that's really what makes this a very different, a very, very different climate change conference from those we saw in the past, including in Copenhagen, which was when hopes were last high for concluding an agreement.
And does that changed attitude include China?
Well, actually, I think a big turning point was reached last year with President Obama and President Xi meeting in Beijing on the margin of the APEC summit, and both of them announced stepped up commitments from their countries on climate change. I think that was a real turning point that China is very, very serious. And not only because it wants to contribute to a global deal, but also we're all seeing these absolutely horrific photos out of Beijing right now with the smog. China has to act in its own interests. Its citizens are being hurt by the heavy fossil fuel footprint in the energy and transport sectors.
What can you say about Australia, New Zealand, and the Pacific in relation to the Paris talks?
Well, the Pacific are very active as part of the Alliance of Small Island Developing States, and they're the ones who've really pushed for much more ambition. These small island countries have wanted a 1.5 degree target for capping temperature rise for quite a long time, and for a while they were on their own. But when you hear the statements from US negotiators and EU negotiators this week saying, hey, they've got a point, they must feel that they've been tremendously successful. Now, New Zealand and Australia, of course, also very visible here. I understand Julie Bishop is here. We're all at so many meetings we don't even necessarily see ourselves on the corridor. But New Zealand has a particular challenge with its emissions reduction, that half the greenhouse gas emissions for my country come off agriculture. So we have to really perform cartwheels to, you know, to try and get those emissions down. Australia, of course, has its big energy intensive industries and a lot of traditional energy generation, which is fossil fuel heavy. But look, I think, you know, Prime Minister Turnbull has always spoken out on these issues with conviction, and I think that, you know, Australia will play a constructive role at these talks.
You speak with a good deal of optimism this morning, yet the reality is it not, in terms of the money, there's not enough being committed to meet the cost, and in terms of reductions to emissions, not enough commitments are being made to reduce the temperature, or at least stop the increase in the temperature to dangerous levels. Why the optimism then?
Well, firstly, before these climate action commitments were put in, and this is a very formal process, right? They've got a ghastly name, Intended Nationally Determined Contribution. Before that process, when we added up the informal commitments countries were making, it was taking us to global warming peaking at probably, you know, 3.7 to 4 degrees Celsius, far, far too high. So these commitments have at least brought that down very considerably. Now, as I say, it needs to come down more, but we're much further ahead than we were. We've got a little window of time to lift that ambition. So that's partly why I'm optimistic. On the money, yes, in 2009, it was said that there would be $100 billion available in climate finance a year. That was never going to be in all in public money. In fact, perhaps a relatively small proportion of it will be public money. A lot of it will have to come from the development banks, from the carbon trading mechanisms. The private sector role is incredibly important, and governments having the right regulatory settings to induce private sector investment into sustainable energy, for example, is very, very important. But what I really care about, James, is that there is enough public finance available for the most vulnerable countries, the dry countries of Africa, the small island states, because they're the ones who have to adapt to a very volatile, unpredictable climate right now. And that's where the big financing needs are.
Okay, Helen Clark, thank you very much. Back to your meetings.
Thanks very much.
The United Nations Development Program Head, former Prime Minister of New Zealand, Helen Clark.